I'm Bristol.
And this week we're going to have Natalie from 350 Vermont come on. Just to talk a little bit about 350 Vermont, reading their mission statement is, 350 Vermont organizes, educates, and supports people in work together for climate justice. Resisting fossil fuels, building momentum for alternatives, and transforming our communities towards justice and resilience.
Yes, so we are very excited to have Natalie on. She is a volunteer at 350 Vermont, and we have a couple of questions for her, and we're really excited for y'all to hear this interview.
Let's get to it. So, just to start off, do you want to introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about how you got into 350 Vermont, and just like a little bit about your background?
Certainly. Yes. Well, my name's Natalie Braun, and I'm a school psychologist. I work in the Burlington School District, and my husband and I have been here for only a little over 5 years in Vermont. I grew up in southern Ohio and spent about 4 or 5 years in upstate South Carolina before we moved to Vermont. And I've been involved in the local node, Burlington node of 350, for about the last 4.5 years.
Nice. How did you get involved with 350 Vermont? Like, how did you find this organization?
I have a lifetime passion for the outdoors and the environment. I grew up out in the country, as I said, in southern Ohio, and also in a family where conservation and thinking about the well-being of the natural world and our connection to the natural world was very present always. So, but quite honestly, it's really only been in the last 10 years or so that I've been much more directly involved in climate activism work and climate work, and most intensely in the last, say, 4.5 here in Vermont. So now to actually answer your question, the lead-in was important because I didn't come up here already affiliated with a specific organization, nothing like that, but because of my and my husband's really genuine passion for the environmental issues, we were just attentive to the events that were happening, things that were going on locally, and, you know, rallies, perhaps, that we might attend to get started. And, I can't even remember, the rally was around, I feel like, something environmental, but 350 Burlington was tabling there, and they were walking around the crowd, and they were getting signatures on something that I don't even remember what it was, probably a petition of some sort, but they had a table there, and they were talking about their organization, and had there been a table for a different environmental organization that I had happened to walk by, we may not be having this conversation, but I'm so glad it was 350 Vermont's table that I happened to walk by and just look down and think, this is it. Yes. And had their mission not been something that I valued or that made sense to me, I would have walked right on by. But it was like, yep, this is it. And whoever was tabling must have been very compelling as well. And so here we are.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's so inspiring. Would you want to tell us a little bit about 350's mission statement?
Oh, gladly. Yes, yeah. So, in essence, it is focused, my understanding and my way of speaking about it, it is that they're really focused, 350 Vermont is focused on the fine art of organizing, and organizing for not only resistance to the fossil fuel infrastructures and the extraordinarily destructive history that has an impact on the environment, but also recognizing building the alternatives to that, because you don't just shut that down and say, oh, well, here we are. You have to completely reimagine and rebuild another way of doing things. So the 350 Vermont that I know and love is really focused on organizing around both of those things, the resistance and the rebuilding alternatives, and then providing the sort of education and opportunities that you need, opportunities for putting your passion into action, you know, that you need in order to make those things happen, not only the resistance, but the building alternatives. I will also say that the overarching philosophy in those two things has to do with what I would describe as climate justice, mm-hmm. and that particularly, I would say, in the last 2 years, a very, very strong focus on when you are particularly rebuilding, that it's a very rebuilding an alternative way of doing business in Vermont and on the earth in general, that there's a real focus on a what you will certainly know as a just transition, so that it's inclusive, it's fair, and it lifts everyone.
For sure. Mm-hmm. This question kind of just popped into my head. How has 350 Vermont, and especially Burlington, since you know this node so well, how has maybe their mission or their projects changed between the last administration and this administration politically, if anything? Like, have you seen any differences between the two?
I just think that I know certainly for me and my circle of activist friends in the Burlington node and in other areas, the past administration was electrifying in terms of the horror mm-hmm. with which we beheld what, you know, the dominoes that were falling in front of us. And certainly, I think for me at least, I probably scaled up 200% in wow. terms of letter writing and, mm. 100%, let's say. And I think that was the case, you know, for the people in the Burlington node. You know, we just tried to press on the accelerator. I don't think we are letting up on the accelerator, though, in terms mm. of that what we might perceive now as some, we don't have any breathing room. Mm. That's the thing is, it would be lovely to think that, oh, okay, the crisis is over.
Right.
No, it is so far from over mm-hmm. as yeah. to be laughable. But it's not laughable. That's mm-hmm. the problem. Mm-hmm. It is, so I think that we are more optimistic in terms of being able to move faster toward, you know, more diligently towards solutions that will save us, you know.
Yeah, totally.
But it is, but so that's the difference. But we're equally intense, I would say, because time has passed and things have not gotten better. So whatever we were able to take, kind of breathe deeply when the previous administration went out, it's just a big inhale and like, yep, more years have passed. Mm-hmm. We're not slowing down. So that was a long answer to a long question, I know.
That was perfect. Yeah, that's just really nice to hear, because I feel like after the inauguration, like, I kind of did take a breath, like, okay, we could just relax for a second, but we still have to press on with these issues, because it's just, like, you can't go without it, you know, so that's really good to hear.
Yeah, it's nice to hear that also your organization is, like, still keeping up with the momentum that you said was basically double what it was before even the Trump administration, so that's an awesome thing to hear, very inspiring.
And let me just clarify, it wasn't that we did doubling more, I don't think, because we had COVID in there, et cetera,
right. mm-hmm.
but we just, it certainly just electrified us in terms of, I think, probably bringing more people in, a few more people in, and just knowing that if this continues this way, we have twice the fight that we, well, not twice, but even a worse problem than we already have and still currently have of catapulting toward some catastrophic things.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Thank you for all your work already.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's already, like, sounds so amazing.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about 350 Vermont's name and, like, where the 350 came from?
The organization started with a group of students and Bill McKibben at Middlebury College in 2008, and they chose the name 350 because that's the kind of safe concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million. Mm-hmm. So they thought, well, now this is a good name. Now, the only thing is, when I first heard it, I thought there is something to be said for being able to recognize immediately when you hear an organization's name what they're all about. Mm-hmm. And the number of times I've answered the question, and this is unrelated because I knew you were going to ask this question, but what is 350? It gives you the opportunity to then say what I'll say now, which is that, so here we are about 13 years later, and the concentration in, let's see, I think it was May 2020, was 417 parts per million. Mm. So we are way above the safe level of CO2. So it does give me the opportunity, even though it doesn't have like a lot of name recognition, 350.org, gives whoever's in it the opportunity to say, well, now let me tell you what this means. So that's what that means.
Yeah, it definitely provokes some thought. I actually enjoy that it's giving us a little bit of opportunity for ourselves to research. Does 350 Vermont collaborate with any other 350 organizations outside of the state or even globally?
I think there's a very strong alignment of mission between the two in terms of they're really focused on this just transition away from fossil fuels and to a sustainable, renewable economy, economic model. But what is interesting too, and I would say, well, you know, I was here, the Trump administration was in most of the time I've been here, so it's tricky for me to say this completely accurately, but I would say that at the time of that administration, I began to hear more also and see much more collaboration among, say, the surrounding states, the 350, like 350 New Hampshire, 350 New York. And so I think my sense is that even though each state is underneath the 350 umbrella, working on very specific campaigns within their own state, they all have that vision of limiting, resisting the fossil fuels, and maximizing alternatives. I would be astonished if we found any that were widely divergent from that. And I think the ones in the New England area are very much in that line.
Yeah, I was going to say, so the class that we're both in, we just learned about Pacific Climate Warriors. I don't know if you ever heard of them before, and they have 350 Pacific, and they completely reject the use of fossil fuels, like you were saying. So that's really cool to hear that, the mission statement's pretty much the same all around.
I think it would be very hard if you are an affiliate of 350.org as a state organization. I can't imagine that you would even want to be terribly divergent.
Yeah.
But what's nice is I would imagine that each state then in that sort of umbrella mission gets to walk the journey that makes the most sense for them locally.
Right. Okay, so now that we understand a little bit more about the mission and what you guys are all about, how is that like being enforced? Is it through education? Is it through advocacy work? Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
So I would say that, like I said before, that if you sort of break the mission into two parts, one is the fossil fuel resistance, the let's have less of this, and then let's have more of this, and that being the alternatives. I think 350 Vermont, well, and I'm guessing, because I've been on a number of calls and workshops and things offered by 350.org also. So again, they're working very hard educationally, but you were asking about 350 Vermont. I think 350 Vermont has done a terrific job of trying to offer trainings to support that general mission. And then they have a staff collective and each of those staff collective members mentors a node, because the nodes are all volunteer. So I'm a volunteer. The node members are all volunteers. But the staff is extremely responsive to questions that we have, needs that we have, and each staff collective member mentors one or more of the 350 Vermont nodes. So basically, you know, how do you interface with legislation? How do you promote legislation, support legislation? Very big one is nonviolent direct action. And that comes into play very often with the resistance movement, the fossil fuel resistance. And just think, as you know, the incredible level of nonviolent direct action that's occurred in the racial justice, climate justice domain in the last year. And I don't, did I remember to say that in the last year or two, how significant the racial justice, climate justice focus has become on the national organization as well as statewide, so that it's a very much of a climate. As a matter of fact, the mission statement, I think, even has the words climate justice in it. A lot of work around all the rewilding strategies, and that's the drawing down. That's the regenerative. Very big in Vermont. One of our campaigns is, in addition to the many ways you can resist fossil fuels, you can, if you think about drawing down the carbon, you're careful not to put any more out than you have to, and how much can you draw down? And in Vermont, we're focusing on sequestering carbon through regenerative agriculture and tree planting and preservation of forest blocks also. They, by way of further trainings, just how to build leadership, building ground leadership training, and coming to your question now, the climate justice, racial justice. As a matter of fact, I said 2 years ago, I want to say it was probably 3.5 years ago, that I believe I attended their first sort of prototype of the climate justice, racial justice workshops that 350 Vermont does. And virtually everything we talk about now, trainings, you know, there are a number, it's not just trainings. You asked about how do they support us. There are also regular meetings of node leaders that speak to the, where we collaborate and see what one another are working on. But there's always, there's the land acknowledgement, and there is the how do we think in terms of food security. The tree planting campaign is heavily focused on trying to increase the opportunity for harvesting and foraging from the trees that are planted. So it is uniform across all the work they're doing, to be seeing it through an equity lens.
Kind of just a follow-up on that, what do you think about the McNeil biomass plant for renewable resources?
There's enormous controversy, as you no doubt know, that surrounds the use of biomass, and I'm not wild about it. That's the short answer. I, not at all. I believe that it would be one thing if we had just a massive amount of absolutely scrap, non-usable wood that is what was being brought to burn in these plants. But unfortunately, now I'm not as familiar maybe with what's coming into the McNeil. I know what I know what they say is coming in, but is it really that there is not massive harvesting happening of things where the climate benefits of leaving those growing would be much better than to transition them to electricity production at the McNeil? I know that there are massive challenges in the southeastern United States with the, and I want to say it's illegal harvesting that's happening, also for shipping biomass products to Europe as well. So it's a problem.
Yeah.
And we're going to need to get beyond the use of biomass.
Yeah, for sure. We were learning about in Brazil the industrialized tree plantations and how, you know, people say it's a renewable source, but it's so obviously not, because the carbon sequestration is just, it's just not offsetting it. And also, like you were saying with the equity lens, like completely drives indigenous people from their land. So that was kind of off topic, but yeah, I was wondering what your opinion on was.
Well, and a monoculture as well. You know, there are all, that's the whole thing, like with regenerative agriculture, is you want cover cropping, you want no-till, you want a rotation of crops, you want animals if they're appropriate. When you have these massive monocultures, whether they're palm oil plantations or what you're growing for biomass, there's just, that's not the natural ecological way that we need to get back to.
Yeah, thank you for all of that insight. Yeah. It was great. And I guess we should get back on track. We were curious if you've ever met resistance for any of the projects that you've been a part of or know that 350 Vermont has had.
The only thing I will just on the lowest level, I certainly, or my fellow node folks, have certainly been in situations. We haven't talked a lot about divestment. So if you have, in terms of the resistance to fossil fuels, kind of that category. You know, I've certainly been at protests in front of, say, for example, TD Bank in Vermont, you know, in Burlington and in Montpelier one day, I believe it was. And, you know, you get all sorts of interesting comments and gestures from folks going by, but not counter-protesters. I have not encountered that. But then I've certainly been, I or, again, my node colleagues have either been in situations where I'm not in a position now where I want to risk arrest because of work and all of that. I just would prefer not to need to take days off.
Totally.
This kind of thing in order to go to court. But that's coming, I think, for me, though. It's just really when I'm not employed any longer. But I've been at events where my friends have absolutely risked arrest. Again, the whole nonviolent direct action protocol was in place where that's all managed in a certain way. But I would have been, say, along, let's take the Vermont gas pipeline under Gepraggs Park. That was one where I was on more than one occasion along the roadway with signs, and then my friends, as well as many other people, were down in the pipeline pit, you know, and not resisting arrest, but risking arrest, and
okay,
they were arrested because they were stopping the work. So I've watched that occur. Probably the biggest one, and I don't know if you're familiar with the No Coal, No Gas organization and the last remaining functioning coal-burning power plant in Bow, New Hampshire. That was a beautifully orchestrated local, but you're talking about, you know, New Hampshire, New York, Connecticut, lots of allied groups, and came together and a beautifully orchestrated nonviolent direct action to remove buckets of coal from a secured environment. You know, you're not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
I and lots of other people were part of the rally and support protest near the grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think it was 69 people who were arrested as they were taking the buckets of coal from the, you know, from the property. So
wow.
I've watched that happen. And if you go in knowing, these are very carefully planned generally. You go in knowing you're either going to risk arrest or you're not. And you have two different roles. The thing where I have been directly requested to stop doing this, please, me, was, you know, I've witnessed it happening, but was we were doing, and I'm trying to remember, this was some years ago, we were unfolding and dropping a banner off of the I-89 overpass near Staples there.
Yeah.
And it was no doubt a, you know, no fossil fuels big banner.
Okay,
and
yeah.
we were hanging it over the side, and I was up there. And the police came, and they I have to say, they were very nice, but that was a no-go. So we had to roll that banner up, but we did a major banner drop there, all on, I think, all overpasses on 89 across the state once, early in the morning.
Did this have anything to do with the Sunrise Movement? I know that they did a banner drop, I believe it was last year or 2 years ago, similarly in the morning, but I don't believe that people stayed there all day. I'm not sure of all the details, but...
What? Totally separate. The one I'm telling you where they stopped me, where they stopped us on the overpass, that was in the middle of the day, and that was
okay.
Just one place. There was a very coordinated banner drop. Now, was that one that involved the sunrise? I'm not sure. That might have been a little bit before.
Okay, I kind of expected that.
Same general idea, though, where you drop the banner and you hook it, and then you're gone. In the case with South Burlington, that was the one banner. We were standing there waving. You know, it was one of those things.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, let's put this banner here and disappear. No, we were there waving.
I bet that was also very empowering, though.
Yeah, for sure.
It was interesting. Yeah, it really was. Yeah, yes, it was.
Have you, like, your experiences with the police, seeing your friends arrested or, you know, just being asked, have you seen the police are, like, generally understanding, or do, like, they really just not want people in these areas protesting?
Well, I'm usually at a remove. I'm usually at a distance, so mm-hmm. I don't hear what's being said. Again, because every person I've ever seen arrested in these circumstances have all had the training, so they know just what to do.
Oh.
So the police have not had to, you know, that they might have carried somebody, but that person is not resisting arrest.
Okay.
So it's, you know, and again, this is so challenging a question because it's, I've not seen the police be violent mm-hmm. against any of them, but I've had very minimal experience with watching this. I will also say to you, however, there was no person of color among any of these folks.
I was just about to ask
that. That I remember.
Yeah.
Oh.
Regrettably, the very white movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, yeah, historically.
And what year was this in?
Well, this would have been about 4 years ago.
Yeah, oh, okay.
The Prags Park. And then the one at the No Coal, No Gas would have been about a year and a half ago, I think. For me to say no person of color there, but very few. Very few.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm assuming you know the point I'm making here.
Yes.
These were all white folks who could afford to be arrested.
Yeah.
Now that sounds, and I'm not saying they're all wealthy, but they had taken the measure of the costs and benefits.
No, yeah, afford in different ways.
Put themselves on the line that a person of color could maybe never do.
Yeah.
For
mm-hmm.
so many reasons. Yeah.
Thank you for saying that. I was literally just about to ask that, then you took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah, yes. Thank you. So moving on to one of our next questions. Since Vermont's main greenhouse gas and fossil fuel consumption is transportation, do you think that electric cars are the answer to reject fossil fuels in the state and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions?
You being in the transportation sector in your internship, oh goodness, no. Yes, but only part of mm-hmm. the answer. Only part. I think, and I'm hoping, now I don't know if I hope I'm wrong about this or not, but I think Vermont has one of the highest per capita, our transportation emissions are well above most of New England, I believe.
It does,
thinking, but I think we have one of the highest per capita pickup truck ownership.
Mm-hmm,
I don't know
yeah.
where I heard that, but we have the choice of vehicles. I think that we are going to need some brilliant marketers to help people understand the importance of energy efficient cars, energy efficient vehicles, whether they're electric or not. But because I think that we have, I think, a very, very high, like, pickup truck, well, an SUV ownership in the state and large SUVs. So I think that ethos of what you drive in this state is, I think, wildly problematic. Now, if you're a farmer, makes sense. I mean, if you're a carpenter, makes sense that you have a pickup truck. But I can, there's probably a four-door pickup truck in every other driveway in my neighborhood, which is ridiculous. So I think, I'm sorry, this is a hugely hot topic for me.
No, yeah, we appreciate
you're gonna
like,
need
all your input.
Major marketing somehow mm-hmm. to turn people away from this ethos of pickup trucks and big SUVs. So if that can be done, anyway, you're going to need more than just availability of electric cars,
mm-hmm.
I think. You've got to produce that electricity for those cars somehow. So let's say suddenly you could get a Dodge Ram four-door pickup truck in electric. They have to be affordable, and you have to have the charging infrastructure, which we do not have yet, and you have to be able to produce the electricity for those as well at a rate that people are willing to pay.
And hopefully renewably, too, like renewable energy to charge them.
Yeah. And look at how inexpensive gas is now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to need a huge a huge marketing, public will shifting campaign around what you drive. And the other thing, of course, is making mass transit, low emissions, other forms of transit much more attractive and available.
I think that's
going to be very important also.
For sure. The big problem I always have with like electric cars is that they're just so expensive and so inaccessible to so many middle and lower income communities, along with like marketing and making mass transit, you know, not stigmatized so much. I think some kind of incentives to get people to buy them and to use them is also a huge thing.
On top of that, most people have to buy electric cars new, so that's also just another issue in itself.
It's quite a, you know, and again, as you said, and I knew that, I mean, you know, the thermal sector, the heating, the weatherization piece is right behind the cars, but it's still, the transportation is still the biggest. And you've got a lot of folks in outlying areas and where there's not, you know, you do have to drive pretty far to get to the grocery store or work. And that's a whole other thinking thing in terms of smart growth and how do you localize the populations so that you are minimizing the amount of travel required. That's a whole other angle on reducing transportation emissions.
Kind of go along with that question, and obviously since 350 Vermont just has so many projects about reducing fossil fuel reliance, do you think that Vermont will ever reach that 90% renewable energy by 2050, which is, you know, the overall goal of our comprehensive energy plan? Do you think we'll actually meet that goal in 2050?
You know that we're going backwards, not forward. we're losing ground, not gaining ground on that. I probably should give you my answer after I say to you, I am a relentlessly optimistic individual.
Okay.
So my feeling is that we keep putting one foot in front of the other on these things, regardless of how far away the goal is. So that allows me to say, no, I don't think so.
Okay.
not at the rate we're going.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, does that mean we don't go? That we stop? Absolutely not. But much like what I was saying about the transportation, I think it is going to require several more significant shifts in public opinion and public understanding of this. I just think for folks, so for many folks, it is still a very distant, disengaged knowing of this problem. It happens to be front and center in my thinking. But I just think that it is, as a psychologist, it's just fascinating to me as to how to help people understand the gravity of this situation and to be willing to make the sort of shifts that are going to be necessary. And it's going to feel like a loss. But I think that at the rate of public understanding and public and political will around this, I think we will have a very hard time reaching 90% renewable. I'm sorry, there was something else I was going to say about that. Is that's too late? 8% renewable by like 2030.
30, yeah.
Not 2050.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing everywhere. It's 2030. It can't be
2050. Oh, it's way. So it's like, well, yeah, even if we did make it, it's kind of too late. I feel like it could be too late.
Yes.
Too late for anything other than just massive crises on a pretty elaborate scale.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate your point of view. Like, you seem to really look at the realities of the subject matter.
It helps to have to be willing to say we are in serious trouble.
Yeah.
It helps if you tend to be a born optimist. Because otherwise, you just want to crawl under the bed and not get out.
Seriously.
Yeah, but so it's maybe a little easier for me to just stand here and I'm still smiling, you know, and say, yeah, we're in serious trouble, and what's next? That's my thinking. So what are we going to do?
You're saying, like, what's next? Like, taking a little step backwards, can you tell us a little bit how COVID has changed the mission and, like, actually what is next for 350?
I think everything I've talked about is on the docket. That's what we're doing.
Awesome.
And I don't think we never stopped. We never stopped. I think, and you know, if I really thought deeply about this or talked to some of the staff collected folks, they would say, oh yeah, Natalie, we shifted all kinds of things. The only thing, my sense, at least for me, that shifted was the way we did our trainings and the way we did our meetings and the way we thought about that. We didn't change necessarily what trainings we did, and the way we thought about, okay, how do we organize during a time when we can't really organize robustly in the street? And yet we did. We were out intermittently with masks on, et cetera.
Yes.
But it is, so if for me, it only changed the fact that everything was transitioned to online, and that there wasn't as much kind of in your face, in the street stuff for a period of time. Yes.
Okay, yeah.
But a year's a year, but in the scheme of things, it's like, okay, it was a year.
Yeah.
And here we are. We're probably going to be able to get back out there much more again now. The one thing I did notice, though, the one thing, and again, this coming from an optimist, is what it did show us, if we can hang on to this, that period of COVID, is that it is possible to slow down, to consume less, in terms of the resources that go into our scurrying lives, to travel less, which I know it was heartbreaking for some folks, and that it's possible to still craft a fulfilling existence. And again, this is tragic and awful occurrences aside. I recognize those are all there. I know that, of the staggering losses that people have experienced. But it kind of brought us to a standstill that had some real grace to it. And if we could hold on to that vision of, you know, life can slow down and be less consumptive, consuming, and be fulfilling and joyful. That has been a lesson I hope we can, to use not a pleasant word, but a good one, I think, we can exploit.
Yeah.
That memory, I'm hoping.
I like that.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, we are just so happy to hear that COVID really hasn't impacted much of the organization except for just being online. But kind of piggyback off that, are there any local projects in Burlington that people can join currently or in the future or anything like that?
Yeah. Can I back up and just say one thing about the organization,
of course,
too?
Definitely.
I was really blessed with having minimal impact on my life from COVID. So I still have a job. I still go to work. I went to work much of the time. So it's, I don't want to say, I think everybody within the organization, which is majority volunteers, I can't speak for how their particular, any particular specific anguish, the personal anguish that they might have had, either professional or personal. And I don't in any way doubt that everybody has a story that isn't pleasant within 350, but we kept going. I mean, they really just stepped it up, the staff collective did. But just, I don't want to make it seem like, oh, it was great and fine for everybody. I'm sure it wasn't. What can be done? Let's see here. So right now, we're in the midst, as you know, of the tree planting campaign as part of the Let's Sequester. And so we have tree planting opportunities coming up. The spring order for trees has gone in. And the particular organizations that are going to use those that come in will potentially need hands to help plant, to be determined. There are going to be seed collecting opportunities, and that's a different conversation as to direct seeding of brownfields and that sort of thing, but that's another sequestering issue. But that wouldn't happen until the fall. We are probably going to start our bike rides, our bike blasts in Burlington. Brattleboro has refined this to a high art. I think theirs have started, but we may be starting some art builds. I heard about a banner drop. I won't say a lot more about it right now, but a possible banner drop coming up in April, for which there would be art builds. And then you've got taking a look on the 350 Burlington Facebook page. We try to get our upcoming events on there. Oh, well, we don't try. We do get our upcoming events on there. The 350vermont.org has a calendar of events. And the two other things I would say, especially for you all, is you've got the whole Fridays for Future, the International Fridays for Future, which is the student climate strikes, on Fridays. So, and Sunrise Movement would certainly be hooked into this as well. Mm-hmm. If you go to the Fridays for Future website, that's really valuable. And just beginning to talk to people about it. A lot of this is done word of mouth, is that you are turning people on to where we are and where we need to be, and beginning by relationship to build the political will for some of the tougher things that are going to need to happen coming up. And so just word of mouth. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, we'd love to hear that. I will definitely link the 350 Burlington Facebook page in the description of this podcast so people can access that. So thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, just kind of as a last question, do you have any closing thoughts or word of inspiration or maybe your favorite part of the job, anything like that?
I think probably just that I've said it in pieces in the last X number of minutes already, is that it's very easy if you do have someone who is becoming interested in becoming more active in the climate movement. And you have sort of on the micro and the macro level, I think what we've learned is you can definitely put those LED bulbs in and you can be riding your bike, which is fabulous. I love it when folks ride bikes. Mm-hmm. But we also are going to be, we're going to have to be working as we are on system-wide change. And that's pretty much everything we've been talking about, is promoting system-wide change. So it is no longer just enough to have to have the LED bulbs, et cetera. Those things are important. That said, my feeling is, in terms of getting folks in the door and thinking more deeply about how to be part of the systemic change, is either through legislation or helping with divestment movements, whatever it happens to be, is that my feeling is that no thoughtful act, I feel this way about kindnesses also, but in this case it's going to be no thoughtful act on behalf of the environment, however small it is without value. No thoughtful act. It all has value, and this is a very long game. And so I, maybe even you all, are not going to see the end of this. Mm-hmm. I certainly won't. But this is a very long process. Think civil rights movement. Think women voting. Yes. That sort of thing. It's a long process to bring about these changes. And so I think of myself as one link in a long chain of things that will happen that I won't see, kind of the promised land, if you will, but I will, whatever that looks like. There are other things that crop up, of course, but it's a joy if you can get your head around things I do have value, and I am part of the process. I'm part of the integrity of this honorable process.
I love that. It's kind of like, I feel like it's the same, like every grain of sand matters, that was amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
that was a great to leave this off with.
Wasn't it? Yes. Why are you throwing those starfish into the ocean? What does it matter? Well, it matters to that one.
Totally.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that it is so incredibly exciting, exhilarating about what's evolved in the last, in my knowing, 3 or 4 years, is the incredible impact and energy that young people, ranging all the way from, elementary school through college age, are bringing to this movement. And because I think historically it's tended to be, folks who have extra, they're always the exceptional, extraordinary people who are doing it while they still have, 8 kids and are working 3 jobs. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it's been a white individuals who have the time and the resources to do these sorts of extra things. And I'm just more and more and more, we're getting just so many people, Indigenous, Black, other people of color, coming in and joining, hugely important, along with the youth. So yay to you all for doing this podcast and being in the programs you're in.
Thank you.
You make my day.
Oh, that is so wholesome. Thank you so much.
Just heard from, again, Natalie from 350 Vermont and in the Burlington node. Honestly, that was personally my first interview for this podcast. I know Bristol's already done one, but that was really amazing, so inspiring to hear someone, especially from a different age group than us, talk about climate. And just, she had so many experiences that she shared with us. It was great.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like, I mean, Natalie was awesome, and just as this podcast continues and we get more guests on, I think we're gonna have some really good conversations. And I was just so glad that Natalie was one of the first people to start those.
Yeah.
So thank you again, Natalie. If anyone is interested in joining one of the 350 Vermont Burlington Node projects, we will link them in the description. And thanks again.